The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
And follow people reading, but I'll try to go slowly and in a measured pace. I'm going to be talking about Du Bois' early sociology of race, sort of the intellectual academic conditions in which he articulated a sociology of race unmoored from the social Darwinist and biological determinist basis that this, you could say, the science or study was based on at the time. The life and legacy of W.E.B. Du Bois has long been a vital topic of retrospective for academics and activists alike. The sheer volume of his historical and journalistic output and evolving strategic vision during recurring cycles of black struggle, however, have given birth to a wide variety of interpretations of the man, his work, and his politics. In the hagiography of Du Bois, it is as if he is a man for all seasons. His writings can be used to articulate a vision of black enfranchisement that gives an educated elite a leading role, seemingly unmoored from a mass politics. Different phases of his writings for the crisis seem to emphasize different avenues of struggle, political, social, educational, and even in a pre-Marxist phase, there seems to be a period in which he conceived of fighting segregation through voluntary segregation and a period of creating forms of economic cooperation, which then might help the black community survive the depression. In the following remarks, I would like to chart out the conditions of Du Bois' early innovations in the sociology of race, and hopefully yield some insights into an intellectual trajectory that would culminate in a heterodox Marxism that, in the final years of his life, included induction into the Communist Party and renunciation of his American citizenship. In essence, what I would like to do here is attempt to provide the origins of the formation of the distinctively Du Boisian approach to black oppression that can perhaps be resuscitated across a lifetime of often diverging political and strategic stances. Ones that also involved a changing understanding of the history of American capitalism and the role of race within it. Building off, but also diverging from Alden Morris's recent book, The Scholar Denied, Du Bois and the Origin of Modern Sociology, I will argue that Du Bois's early attempts to articulate a social scientific explanation of racial difference at the turn of the 20th century set the course of his engagement with the problem of black oppression in very specific ways. First of all, as Morris painstakingly shows, his attempts at actually investigating the social factors affecting black life in America went largely unnoticed or were actively ignored by white colleagues at elite institutions, despite his adherence to relatively conventional ideals of social science of his time. Secondly, his steady but relatively swift rejection of concepts and schemes in any way related to biological essentialism nevertheless brought him into collaboration with other leading lights of social science of his time, like Franz Boas and Max Weber. And I will try to briefly sketch the character of his correspondence with these two classical founders. And finally, by putting into question the very status of race itself as a concept of any explanatory power, Du Bois was always, or as of any scientific validity, Du Bois was always poised to revisit the problem of black oppression through a strategic horizon that placed integration in American society at large as the ultimate goal. When Du Bois returned from graduate studies at the University of Berlin in the emerging field of sociology, he could not have found a more unreceptive academic environment for his vision of founding a sociology of black life. Firstly, there was an ever-present American tradition of racist white snobs who could not countenance a fellow black scholar in their midst. But perhaps more importantly, American sociology was still a new discipline, with founders who maintained a diffident preoccupation with legitimizing their field with as much natural scientific terminology and theory as possible. Thus, the evolutionary theory of Darwin and others provided the closest cluster of concepts and explanations for the observable differences and inequalities within and between human societies. While it is often observed that 19th century intellectuals generally couch their arguments in the language of evolutionary stages, Marx for example, early sociologists were guilty of a particularly malignant appropriation of evolutionary phraseology that explained just about every physical, behavioral, and social cultural circumstance as merely a moment of the survival of the fittest. In fact, we should say that social Darwinism as a general cultural attitude and the thought of Herbert Spencer in particular found their ideal niche within the American academy around the turn of the 20th century. Mostly white elites in major cities found themselves increasingly wading through streets teeming with masses of immigrants of wide-ranging European ethnicities, and to an increasing extent, blacks migrating from the South. Thus, one of sociology's founding questions was how this mosaic of peoples should or possibly even could be integrated into American society. While on the worst end of the spectrum, the eugenics movement pushed for a sterilization project that would winnow down those races considered mentally inferior or criminally deviant, more sympathetic voices argued in neo-Lamarckian tones that the biological givens which underlay certain social behavioral inferiorities could be adapted to alter old instincts and perhaps become inherited in later generations. Sort of a basic idea that through cultural education, certain traits and habits would be learned that would then get passed on to individuals' progeny. When it came to blacks and their role in society, the sociologist Grove Dow provided the following description of the traits and temperaments of blacks. A greater power of memory, stronger sexual passions, submissiveness rather than pugnacity, a large sense of sociability, and a greater ability to read character and interpret one's thought, that he is emotional in religion, that he has a smaller capacity for group organization and for government, that he is more influenced by imitation, emotion, and emulation than by rational thinking and purposeful direction. The ideological character of this discourse should be evident for all, not least for the way it analogizes the biological with social forms of determination, but also for the readiness it had to seize upon varied racial stereotypes of supposed physical, mental, and spiritual differences, and mixing and matching them with an equal measure. Within this horizon of theories and academic respectability, the young Du Bois struggled to find funding and recognition for his planned investigation of the social conditions of blacks. In one of his autobiographies, Dusk of Dawn, Du Bois recalled his first exposure to scientific racism in a way that is also very instructive regarding his own thinking on race at this time. He writes, "At Harvard, I began to face scientific race dogma. First of all, evolution and the survival of the fittest. It was continually stressed in the community and in the classes that there was a vast difference in development of whites and the lower races. And this could be seen in the physical development of the Negro. Eventually in my classes, stress was quietly transferred to brain weight and brain capacity, and last to the cephalic index. In graduate school at Harvard and again in Germany, the emphasis again was altered, and race became a matter of culture and cultural history." From this quote and other evidence in earlier writings, for example, a speech called The Conservation of Races, Du Bois was already a step ahead of the mainstream of the field of sociology of race in isolating culture and its historical development as the locus from which to analyze, interpret, and explain observed differences between races. Obviously, as a black man of high intellectual distinction, the young Du Bois would not accept biological theories of black inferiority, but he often wrote in a manner that borrowed from the then pervasive lexicon of white and bourgeois paternalism, describing the cultural deficits and traits of blacks as primitive, childish, deficient, intemperate, as did many other black leaders at the time. At this time, Du Bois basically considered these weaknesses to be traces of the experience of slavery, the inadequacy of Reconstruction, and the troubling new urban environment that was beginning to be populated by blacks. And you could say also one of the key innovations of Du Bois at this early stage is to recognize that sociology of race and the black question was no longer to be understood simply as one of the southern particularities of America, but that it had an urban dimension to it too. In a speech in the late 19th century, The Conservation of the Races, Du Bois defined race as a vast family of human beings, generally of common blood and language, always of common history, traditions, and impulses, who are both voluntarily and involuntarily striking together for the accomplishment of certain more or less vividly conceived ideals of life. Here, you can see Du Bois is participating in this combination of spiritual and biological underpinnings that reveals a minimal adherence to race as a real category that would validly distinguish people, but it also reflects a kind of cultural relativism that he must have inherited from education in Germany, sort of German historicism that sees each nation and culture as containing something singular and distinct, and no single one being better than another. Thoroughly rejecting any imputation of inferiority and instead emphasizing that American blacks had endured the greatest sin of modern civilization, Du Bois thought it necessary to reinvigorate the culture and morals of blacks to make them prosperous and proud participants in civilization. Much of the writing in this early phase of his career sought to use sociological insight and rhetorical verve to overturn the racist and prejudicial notions of American experts and public alike regarding the Negro problem. Du Bois phrased it thusly, "The basic question is, how soon after a social revolution like emancipation ought one reasonably to expect the appearance of habits of thrift and the accumulation of property? Moreover, how far is the accumulation of wealth indicative of general advance in moral habits and sound character? Or how far is it independent of them or in spite of them? Statistics and analysis of social relationships could be deployed for the purpose of making comparative assessments that would prove that other racial groups under similar circumstances were bewitched by the same problems or similar ones. Racism at this stage of his writing, though recognized as deeply entrenched, especially as an inheritance of Southern slavery, is not seen as a necessary aspect of labor exploitation under American capitalism. So too, the negative cultural traits of blacks are seen as traces of slavery and a legacy of dependence that would be improved upon as the race ascended this ladder of civilization. As with many sociologists of this time, the basic problem of the character of capitalist civilization that blacks might eventually participate in did not yet come under explicit focus for Du Bois. In works like The Philadelphia Negro and The Souls of Black Folk, I would argue that Du Bois had the following standpoint for understanding and criticizing the position of blacks in American position of blacks in American society. Sociology should be used as a social policy guide that could help understand the breakdown and hopefully help stabilize classically bourgeois social institutions like the family, the corporation, voluntary associations. But conversely, this seemingly conventional ideal of sociology could be used to turn a mirror on the racist character of regimes of exclusion and inequality that plagued black social life long after slavery had been abolished. In my remaining remarks, I'd like to turn to the way in which Du Bois moved away from a language of inherited cultural traits towards what we would now call a social constructionist framework for understanding race, and how he did so in correspondence with Boas and Faber. In 1906, Du Bois brought the Columbia anthropologist Franz Boas to speak at an Atlanta University conference entitled "The Health and Physique of the Negro American." By this time, Boas had been making a name for himself as a debunker of commonly held opinions, like the supposed relationship between certain physical characteristics and intelligence. He is one of the first systematic debunkers of the cephalic index, or cranial size, as related to measurements of IQ and intelligence, as well as supposed inherited IQ of people who lived in primitive conditions versus more materially rich civilized conditions. He wrote a book called The Mind of Primitive Man, which in a sense collected this array of argumentation. At the conference, Boas dispatched the various claims of black inferiority with confidence and placed the supposed hierarchy of civilizations in world historical perspective, emphasizing the inventive genius of Africans in constructing magnificent kingdoms based on technological breakthroughs that lifted human civilization to new heights. Finally, Boas rejected prominent theories of cultural and social development of the day that asserted that cultures must pass through specific stages or states, and firmly rejected that there was any correlate between race and any particular stage of cultural development that a population might find itself in, or that one that an anthropologist would observe them. Du Bois, retrospectively, in 1939, recalled his reaction to Boas. "I remember my own rather sudden awakening from the paralysis of this judgment taught to me in high school and two of the world's great universities. Franz Boas came to Atlanta University, where I was teaching history, in 1906, and said to a graduating class, 'You need not be ashamed of your African past.' And then he recounted the history of the black kingdom south of the Sahara for 1,000 years. I was too astonished to speak. All of this I had never heard, and came then and afterwards to realize how the silence and neglect of science can let truth utterly disappear, or even be unconsciously distorted." What was important for Du Bois in this intellectual exchange with Boas was not merely the rejection of scientific racism, but the rejection of a whole language and way of posing black cultural and social development as a problem in itself. Instead, aspects or dynamics within culture or social life should be considered essentially as phenomena dependent on historical causes, dependent on specific regimes of social exclusion, dependent upon inherited histories of, you could say, lived experience. By the time Du Bois wrote an article entitled The Black Question in the United States for Max Weber's Archive for Social Politics later in 1906, he articulated a theory of the relationship between race and class that I believe is the sort of, I would argue, is the beginning of Du Bois' proper orientation towards black oppression, one that I think he would successively return to and find different either historical explanations for its existence or different political and strategic visions for how to change it. But ultimately, this is the, you could say, this theory of a kind of racism in America as a basically a kind of caste system inherited from slavery as something that he would continually return to.
2 minutes left.
He writes, "That problem of the past, so far as the black American was concerned, began with caste, a definite place preordained in custom, law, and religion, where all men of black blood must be thrust. To be sure, this caste idea as applied to blacks was no sudden full-grown conception, for the enslavement of workers was an idea which America inherited from Europe and was not synonymous for many years with the enslavement of blacks, of the blacks. Du Bois uses caste as a specific term in the sociological lexicon because it means something supplementary to social class as constituted simply by market forces. It's a category of social stratification enforced by a system of taboos, prohibitions, exclusions, rules about miscegenation, that you could say permeate throughout the course of the daily interactions between people of a particular caste and their relations with people outside of it. It of course has its classical expression in ancient India Varna system of caste, and I think it was in some sense meant to bring to the fore the paradoxical nature of such a irrational system being being promoted right after after abolishing slavery, and so too the ways in which it was being justified by the pseudoscientific biological racisms of the time.
It's been about 20 minutes if you want to give up.
And I think I'll just leave it at that. Thanks.
Excuse me, I'm getting over a cold. So this is going to be kind of, it's about, Stephen, does everyone know who Stephen Jay Gould is? Have people read him? Who's read Gould? A couple people. He died in 2002, born in 1941. When he died, he was probably the most famous scientist in the country. Mostly known for these columns he wrote every month for Natural History magazine for 300 consecutive months that were then like anthologized periodically as books like Ever Since Darwin, The Panda's Thumb, Hen's Teeth and Horse's Toes. So when Panda's Thumb won the National Book Award, he was on The Simpsons as himself. He was like a talking head on, you know, Charlie Rose, like one of the, kind of like Richard Dawkins, or but better, basically, in the sense that like he also wrote. I mean, he was just prolific. He wrote 500 technical articles. He wrote, I don't know, I forget how specialized books for the general public. When he died, suddenly at 60, he was publishing at that moment a 1,200-page book called The Structure of Evolutionary Theory that's just like, I mean, it's a doorstop, but it's also like kind of like a one-stop shopping place for the entire history of the concept of evolution. I mean, brilliant writer, kind of like a mix of very erudite, like Harvard professor, but also working-class dude from Queens who went to Jamaica High School and could give you like, I don't know, a progressive critique of all kinds of reductionist nonsense and Darwinism that somehow goes through the example of like Joe DiMaggio or the movie It's a Wonderful Life or something like that. Like, brilliant guy. Okay. So I'm mostly going to talk about this, maybe his most famous book called The Mismeasure of Man. Has anyone read this? Yeah, it's widely assigned in undergrad curriculum. It's a history of race science, like from of the idea that we can somehow measure intelligence. For example, like the idea that I'm going to talk about craniometrics, like okay, head size is somehow correlated to intelligence, and like putting some kind of measuring the volume of cranial capacities in races, quote-unquote, like the Blumenbach categories of, I don't know, I mean, the Caucasian, Ethiopian, Malaysian, Asian, and I'm forgetting one of them, but they're nonsense categories anyway. So that craniometrics, the book is mostly actually about, what's it called, IQ testing. And just the history of that and how deeply misguided it's all been and how persistently it continues basically to the present, which in the second edition of the book, which came out in 96, was republished with a new epilogue about the that the reason for the republication and the new epilogue was that it was he wanted to explicitly respond to this book, The Bell Curve, by Charles Murray and Herstein, which, if you don't know about this book, it's basically claims that IQ is more than half of it is inherited somehow, and that for this reason, it's this old specious claim that's been going on since like the late 60s, that for that reason, like, forget about remedial education for minorities, because what difference is it going to make? I mean, they sort of update this idea of Arthur Jensen, which Jensen claims, which is this ridiculous claim that has no evidence but sounds plausible, that it's 80-20, 80% of intelligence is inherited, 20% is subject to educational improvements. So they kind of play on that, like, oh, it's 60-40, we're more enlightened than Jensen. But anyways, Gould, so that's where I want to pick up. Basically, that's sort of the history of this, and I'm going to skip around. Mostly what I'm going to do is go over this controversy that's emerged about Mismeasure of Man in the last 6 years. Is anyone familiar with this? Okay. So I'll go over this a little bit slowly, and then I have, basically I'm going to just give you the he said, she said of the controversy, and then at the end, I have some broader points, but most of this is just exposition of this kind of controversy, non-controversy. Anyways, when Gould died in 2002, his obituary was on the front page of the Times. It was a testament to his standing in our culture, and his achievements as a scientist and public intellectual, including in the sciences, a path-breaking concept called punctuated equilibrium, the idea that evolution is not gradual, it's relatively sudden, and then there's stasis. And the brilliance of this is that way, when you use Gould's concept, that fossil record can be submitted as evidence. Under Darwin's idea, it's a book with the pages missing. So in other words, we can't use the fossil record as much as we would want. And Gould was frustrated by this as a young graduate student professor, and he developed this idea that, no, the read it literally, basically. And then that concept has been widely used in different scales. He was mostly talking about species, how species emerge. But then he was red-baited about it, because it's vaguely sort of resembles a revolutionary time change that would be basically, there's stasis, sudden change, stasis, sudden change, and so on. So anyways, fast forward, so that front page obituary, next time he makes the front page is in 2011. Quote, here's the article. Study debunks Stephen Jay Gould's claim of racism on Samuel Morton's skull collection, which is housed at the University of Pennsylvania Anthropology Museum. A team of physical anthropologists led by Jason Lewis had remeasured the skull collection of a 19th century anthropologist and race scientist Samuel Morton in an effort to disprove one set of claims in Gould's landmark study, The Mismeasure of Man, which is a study of, as I was saying, intelligence testing and critical history of scientific and academic racism. Gould had claimed, and this is canonical in undergraduate education, that Morton unconsciously manipulated his data to demonstrate that the cranial capacities of Caucasians were on the whole greater than those of racial groups in the old Blumenbach categories of Mongolian, Malaysian, Ethiopian, American, and Caucasian. Gould's work involved no remeasuring. He instead worked from Morton's published data. He even credited Morton's transparency in publishing his complete measurement data sets and Morton's scruples in altering his methods for measurements over time. He remeasured the skulls three different times using three different methods that were increasingly accurate. Gould's analysis of Morton's data is canonical, and as I was saying, in the modern curriculum on the issue of error and bias in scientific practice. What was the finding of the group of this new study? That Gould was guilty of unconscious bias and not Morton. Quote, our results resolve this historical controversy, the authors assert, demonstrating that Morton did not manipulate his data to support his preconceptions contra Gould. End of quote. Towards the end of the article, they put a finer point in it. Quote, ironically, Gould's own analysis of Morton is likely the stronger example of bias influencing results, end of quote. The article, thanks in part to the New York Times coverage, had an impact and was cited as proof by Gould's longtime critics that, quote, his ideological stance was supreme, as Jack Holloway, one of the researchers in the remeasuring and reanalysis of the skull collection put it, and Gould was red-baited like throughout his career, even though he wasn't a Marxist. So that so that to give you some sense of that, how this article then has influenced now how people are understanding him now, at a conference on the 10th anniversary of Gould's death in 2012, this took place in Venice, and it was all people sympathetic to him. The curator of Human Origins at American Museum of Natural History on the Upper West Side, Ian Tattersall, summed up the growing consensus in which Morton emerges from the reanalysis, quote, more sinned against than sinning. Quote, it seems that in this case, Gould at least had been prepared to allow his own unconscious bias to color his judgment on Morton. And for Tattersall, the big irony was that Gould proved his own point. Gould's error proves his own point. Be on guard against your own beliefs and predilections. Errors will most likely occur in the details of analysis. And so then Tattersall concludes regarding Gould's overall influence on anthropology. Gould was not a detail man. His strength was the big picture. End of quote. His influence in anthropology was subtle, metaphor and mindset. He credits Gould especially with his energetic and persuasive arguments for conceptualizing hominid evolution not as a linear chain, but as a branching bush where different species often coexisted in our ancestors. Diversity was the key concept behind Gould's notion of bushes, his metaphor of bushes. And Gould was very prescient in this regard about discoveries that would show the complexity and diversity of human origins that occurred over the last 30, 40 years. So that, for example, in the early 1990s, we knew of 11 distinct hominid species. By the mid-90s, we knew of 16. By the early aughts, we knew of 20. And by 2010, we knew of 25, with numerous coexisting lineages. It's not a chain, it's a branch. It's branching. Gould was prophetic on this point. Anyways, Tattersall's like, you know, he was wrong on the details, but he was good at the big picture. And similarly, another person at the conference, Richard Milner, put it like this: if Gould went off on a mistaken path, as he sometimes did, any question of deliberate fraud or hoax is absolutely out of the question. Whatever his conclusions reached on this issue, rightly or wrongly, he did with complete conviction and integrity. If he was guilty of bias in science, this bias he was warning against, at least it was on the side of the angels. In other words, at least it was in the bigger picture. He's correct about, like, there is no, you know, these questions of, like, I don't know, race being somehow a scientific category are flatly wrong. I mean, it has sociological impact and historical impact, but it's not a matter. For example, this well-known idea that, you guys know this, like, in-group diversity is greater than between-group diversity, genetic diversity. So, like, in Africa, among people that have, whose ancestors have never left the continent, there's greater diversity there than there is between people who's have never left and the rest of human geographic patterns. Anyways, these people are sympathetic to Gould's overall project, but they nevertheless acknowledge the apparent legitimacy of the attack on Gould for bias. There's an even sadder implication in their defense, that he was not a man for details. Gould himself, at least, would have been saddened by this assessment. In his monthly essays for Natural History, he prided himself on working from details of nature or history out into the generalities. For example, this famous essay about the panda's thumb, which is not a thumb, it's the wrist bone. And the idea there is that imperfection proves the evolution happened, not perfection. Perfection's an argument for creationism. But that case makes the essay famous. And personally myself, like, one of the most influential things for me from Gould is this line, which is in The Mismeasure of Man, which is that you sneak up on generalities, you don't assault them head on, which I've always found helpful as a writer. But the tale doesn't end there. So apparently, as in one of the laws of the internet, do you guys know the Skits law? The original article's corrections of Gould's errors, this team of researchers, supposed correction of Google's errors, their article is full of errors. Although this has not been as widely reported, which shows kind of the politics of all this, I think. You know, I've been communicating with these other authors now. So this is 2014 now. That original article was 2014. Most recently, critics, mostly working in philosophy, science, and political science, have attacked Lewis and company's analysis itself as flawed. For example, Michael Weisberg and Diane Paul comment in the same journal, Public Library of Science, that Gould's major claim about Morton's unconscious bias still stands. They point out two major problems with Lewis's et al. Study. One is more or less a red herring. The team remeasured half of Morton's skulls with the same method of BB lead shot and found his measures essentially correct, or if anything, slightly overestimating Ethiopian volume. Fine, but so what? Gould did not criticize or doubt the accuracy of Morton's original measurements with this technique. What he had done was compare them to earlier measures using more variable pepper seed technique, where the seed could be compressed and packed, and the measures could not be reproduced reliably, and to which Morton himself was frustrated by. That's why he switched. Gould was correct to point out that while at all the race volumes increased from under the lead shot measurements from the seed, the increase in Ethiopian measures was disproportionately larger. In other words, the change from the less reliable to the more reliable technique for the black skulls was suspiciously larger. In other words, so that, and Gould writes about this, this is Gould now for mismeasurement. Plausible scenarios are easy to construct. Morton measuring by the pepper seed picks up a threateningly large black skull, fills it lightly, and gives it a few desultory shakes. Next, he takes a distressingly small Caucasian skull, shakes it hard, pushes mightily at the foramen magnum with his thumb. It is easily done without a conscious motivation. Expectation is a powerful guide to action. Mind you, this is a hypothetical about the first round of measure in 1839, not the ones carried out with the reliable lead shot and then reproduced by Lewis in 2011. In a related and more detailed analysis, Weisberg's article, Remeasuring Man, also from 2011, takes a more balanced view of what Gould and Lewis each got wrong and concludes that Gould's analysis, Morton, can still be used in an illustration of unconscious bias. One larger contextual point Weisberg makes that hits the mark is that there really is something odd about wanting to rehabilitate Morton's reputation. And this speaks to our current context of so-called race realism and all this like insane biological determinism that's becoming mainstream again. Since 2011, since that article, a misconception of Morton has taken hold, namely that, quote, he did not in fact believe that intelligence was correlated with brain size. As Nicholas Wade writes in his recent and widely condemned race science book, A Troubling Inheritance. Rather, Wade continues, he was measuring his skulls to study human variation as part of his inquiry into whether God had created the races separately. As though this, end of quote, as though this question itself were not a fundamentally racist one. In fact, Morton, like all other craniometricians, did in fact assume correlations of brain and intelligence. Why else were they fucking measuring? I mean, yeah, to say, oh, there's people are so different, but this was a fundamental question for all these people. Weisberg quotes him.
2 minutes.
Yeah, Weisberg quotes him in his own words as mixing physical attributes of races with traits of character from racist stereotypes, including, of course, intelligence. And I could read these quotes, but for example, for whites, this race is distinguished for the facility with which it attains the highest intellectual endowments. That's Morton on whites. For Americans, as in Native Americans, in their mental character, the Americans are averse to cultivation and slow in acquiring knowledge. I mean, the guy was, you know, what's at stake in rehabilitating him, basically? And then, overall, just quickly, what is Wiseman up to? Or this guy, Michael Weisman, I've been communicating with him about, because he's also at Penn in the philosophy of science. He's a in philosophy there, philosophy of science, and he basically, I've been communicating, corresponding with him the last couple of days, and I was asking him, like, do you think their motive, what do you think that, why, are they, what are their motivations for this? And he basically said he's not sure. The one person he knows is like a curator there, and she participated in this study to kind of, because she basically thinks the skull collection is neglected because of Gould's use of it in the book, and she wants people to use it for non-racist purposes, essentially. But then he was like, yeah, maybe other people did want to attack Gould. And then if I can just make a couple broader points about the book, really quickly, like, so, yeah, it's a red herring to just remeasure, but this whole thing about Morton that somehow discredits Gould is a red herring about this book in general. The book, Mismeasured Man, is mostly, like, the majority of the book is about the history of IQ testing. And that's much more relevant to our times, essentially. And
last point.
And my last point would just be, why is it that people are so bothered by this book? I think part of it, and why is it so fascinating to read still, is this technique Gould has rhetorically for quotations. Does anyone know this concept? This idea, Walter Benjamin has this really great, really wonderful quote. He says, quotations in my work are like highway bandits that rob you of your convictions. And that's how Gould operates in Mismeasured Man. He quotes authors at their most unbelievable, starting with Plato. And the first page of the book is about how Socrates says, how are you going to get some people to have their inferior position in the world? And Socrates says, very simple, you lie to them. You tell them, you're made of inferior thing. You're made of like a base substance. And the people at the top are made of gold and so on. And Gould says, Socrates, to his credit, knew this was a lie. All these people I'm going to discuss in this book, they're lying to themselves about the fact that human differences are innate and inherited and cannot be remedied the way, you know, the inheritance of bad vision can be remedied by eyeglasses, essentially. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.